Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Makone Maja. Let's get into the news of today. We're going to be talking a little bit about the continuing jobs bloodbath in South Africa. We're going to also be talking about the Julius Malema firearms case. And we're going to be talking a little bit about, if we have time, the right way to view government regulations. So let's start off with the important story for many, many South Africans, even if it's not the sexiest story. And that is that according to the Stats SA's quarterly employment survey, that the number of jobs in the last year has dropped by 229,000 in the second quarter of 2025. And we've lost 80,000 jobs from the first quarter. That's total employment has decreased, as I said, by 229,000 jobs, or 2.1% year-on-year increase between June 2024 and June 2025. So that means that there's about 10.5 million jobs in the country at the moment. Most of the losses were recorded in the community services sector, a significant number also in manufacturing, mining, transport, and trade. Business services gained about 20,000 jobs, electricity gained about 1,000, and construction was flat. So very worrying numbers. Now, it's worth pointing out that this survey does not include, it's not as comprehensive as the other survey that Stats SA does on labor, the quarterly labor force survey, which is kind of has a broader definition of work. This is focusing on more kind of formal types of employment, doesn't include as many informal jobs. But I think the fact remains that the economic situation for millions of South Africans remains very dire and unfortunately is getting worse. Makone, sadly, fairly predictable because despite many hopes for a change in government policy with the formation of the Government of National Unity, very little of that has happened. And the unsurprising result is unemployment's going up. What do you make of this?
I have been very reluctant, had been initially, to critique the Government of National Unity's performance on growth, which is the single most important thing. I think a lot of the issues in the country, ranging from crime, to even crime against women and children, for example, are symptomatic of people that are just quite frustrated with, their financial well-being and the finances of their households. And so I'd been holding off on critiquing the Government of National Unity initially, like last year around December when, the quarterly labor force was being deliberated on and it was evident that, growth isn't forthcoming. But I think they've earned their due now. We're over a year into the Government of National Unity, and outside of the statement of intent, there's still no clear sense of what their plan is to actually get growth going. And where there is a plan, these plans seem to be unveiled on a party level rather than on a synchronized, coordinated effort by the government, showing that this will cut across departments and that, they will receive support, even from Parliament on what the growth plan is. So the IR has belabored the point of growth for over a year now. We've published the Blueprint for Growth paper series, which identifies various industries, various sectors, various low-hanging fruit, even of where growth can flourish, where growth can be, created, how jobs, can be brought into the country, primarily through attracting foreign direct investment. And we've also said, in order to do all of that, you need to get rid of barriers to growth. So I'm not going to try and find like the exact causal relationship between this bloodbath of jobs and specific policy positions of the government, but I think overall, the economy has been bleeding jobs in the last 10 years as a result of anemic levels of growth. We haven't even breached that 1% level of growth over the last 10 years. And so it should have been expected that soon enough, more and more and more job losses would start accumulating. And we read these as job statistics, but these are actually real people, real families who are losing income, who are losing the ability to fund themselves. This is a growing population of South Africans who are dependent on the state for welfare, a growing number of South Africans who cannot meaningfully participate in the economy, are not able to, you know, develop themselves and make use of any skills that they have acquired. And it is clear that the source of that too is government, right? Government has created what we've called fake transformation. It's these policies that are presented as being in the pursuit of alleviating poverty, of helping poor people latch onto, you know, ladder of opportunity, yet it has only furthered the interests of a few. So this is a result of fake transformation policy. We're looking here at policies like BEE or the Employment Equity Amendment Act. And this is not just us saying that these laws are barriers to growth, right? I'm not saying there's a direct relationship between BEE and 230,000 job losses between June 25 and June 24, but I am saying that even the World Bank has identified the ineffectiveness of BEE and how it's caused a decline in service delivery and how the private sector is not able to grow to create jobs because of having their hands tied behind their backs, not able to actually grow their companies because of all these. Either, you know, you have to subsidize your own electricity and build solar panels, or now there's this water crisis that's on the rise too.
Pay for private security.
Private security is an enormous expenditure on South African households and South African businesses. So they are all the cumulative effect of all of these things. We can go down the line, you know, including policy uncertainty that's engendered by things like the NHI and expropriation without compensation has really placed business in a precarious position so that they're not able to actually effect real change on the economy and create jobs. And we're not able to similarly make a convincing investment case for South Africa. But my sense is it's an easy job to erase those barriers to growth. It just takes political leadership that is decisive, that is determined, that has direction. And so far, the GNU hasn't been up to the task.
And if you'd like to read more details about what we think is the way to ensure that South Africa embraces real transformation rather than fake transformation, you can go to irr.org.za/reports. And then you can read our Blueprint for Growth series there, where we talk about various aspects of how to solve South Africa's problems, particularly that of economic growth. Okay, let's get on to the more thrilling piece of news, which I'm sure many of you will be talking about today. And that is, of course, that Julius Malema has been found guilty on a number of charges relating to him firing shots from a rifle back in 2018 in the air. The East London Regional Court found Malema guilty of unlawful possession of a firearm and ammunition, discharging a firearm in a public space, failure to take reasonable precautions to avoid danger to persons or property, and reckless endangerment. They also found him guilty of his co-accused, which was his bodyguard, was found not guilty on the two charges that he was accused of. The magistrate in the case described the state's witnesses' evidence as credible, reliable, and truthful. She criticized Malema directly, saying many questions that warranted a reply were not answered. He told the court he could not count the shots fired because he had graduated from woodwork. These type of answers do not do the accused any favors, she said in her judgment. Malema has said, you know, the usual what you'd expect regarding this. Malema's bodyguard is white, and so Malema has said that the fact that he was let off is a result of racism, and that the case Malema's bodyguard was accused of giving Malema the firearm, which he then shot, which the state was not able to prove. Malema said that if they can't prove that he was given the firearm by Snyman, then the case against him has collapsed, and that this is just the courts doing the business of AfriForum and the Oval Office of Donald Trump. He said all the usual bluster about dying for revolutions, not being afraid to go to jail, et cetera, et cetera, as one would expect from Malema. But he did also say he would appeal the decision. The case's sentencing has been postponed to next year. So we don't know actually what the sentence Malema is going to receive will be. But McCorner, I mean, the consequences for Malema, if he gets a significant prison sentence, could be pretty severe. He won't be able to serve in parliament if his prison sentence is over 12 months. But either way, it just must be a bit demoralizing, considering also that the EFF seems to be in a bit of a rut and Malema has been kind of trying to rejuvenate the party after the defection of some of his allies. What do you make of all this? What do you make of the claims that the court was racist? What do you make of the claims that Malema is not afraid to go to prison? What do you think about all this?
Typical Malema fashion, like you said, to allege racism, take no personal responsibility for his own conduct. He was, when I watched parts of his cross-examination when he was testifying in court, and again, in true to form, he was very insulting in the courtroom towards the prosecutor. He was making a mockery of the case and the answers that he was giving, you know, being very sarcastic, not at all taking the proceedings seriously. He accused the prosecutor in open court of only bringing this case to advance his career. Said he wants to gain popularity, you know, so that he can advance his career as a prosecutor. Just not being serious at all. And he's not able to reflect on that as a possible reason why the judge didn't find in his favor. One of the things, the blatant lies he told in court, this is not me saying this, this is the judgment, is that the gun was a prop, that it was a toy gun, you know, like in the movies. Apparently the ballistics evidence was able to counter that. But I have some grievances with some of the ways in which, you know, the judgment was delivered, like why it took 3 whole days for the judge to deliberate on this, not deliberate, but to actually deliver the judgment. And she does say in the beginning that it's because she wants to go through every little piece of evidence to ensure that each of it is accounted for. I think she understood the storm that she was going to face by the time she had concluded actually handing over the guilty verdict and the not guilty verdict that was given with regards to Malema's bodyguard. And we just tried to do this, I'll share, Nick, that we just tried to go through whatever we could find, like videos, since we can't find the actual cases yet. But going through video evidence to establish why exactly Sneyman was let off. And you found a quote from the prosecutor who was forthcoming about them not actually being able to, you know, make a case for what he was being charged with, which was neglectfully handing over somebody with a firearm, somebody who's not eligible to carry a firearm.
With a loaded firearm
in around public property and around, you know, civilians. So I do think that this carries grave consequences for the EFF. The EFF is a personality cult, you know, just like the MK, whether they like to admit it or not. And it's not clear to me that by Julius Malema's own hand, it seems he has been adamant about ensuring that he faces no political competition and that any possible competition, even when it rises naturally through, you know, the lower ranks of the EFF, is snuffed out and stomped out. You know, that's why I believe we saw the expulsion of people like Mbuyise and Ndlozi. So it seems that he'll have to work extra hard in the next coming years to groom the next EFF leaders if he's not able to successfully appeal this, which, as you say, he says he will be taking this on an appeal. But I thought this was just typical Julius. The difference here is that you've actually found a judge with the appetite to face the consequences of, you know, making a guilty verdict against him. This just hasn't been the case in some of these other cases that, well, at least on my end, seemed to have should have gone against him. But yep, there you have it.
Indeed. So yeah, yet another kind of blow for his situation. And you know, potentially the consequences are going to be rather inconvenient for him. It does, you know, I'm sure lawyers and judges and people in the legal know-how can tell me if I'm going wrong here, but it really seems like this trial should not have taken 7 years to get done, and that's not great. If things are going to have to be dragged out, and of course, you know, the appeal and all of the things that are going to follow, who knows whether we'll get a, you know, final conclusion to this matter by 2030. I mean, maybe I'm just being pessimistic there, but you know, just that doesn't seem particularly good for this whole case. It's just going to be kind of lurking there in the background. But regardless, you know, is Malema, what's Malema going to do if he gets sort of the worst case scenario and he has to go to jail for a year, even if he gets some sort of suspended sentence, if he's not allowed to be in parliament, you know, that's like one of his big platforms. What is he going to do to kind of keep himself in the spotlight? Some difficult political problems, I think, for Malema coming from this, in this case. So, yeah, no, yet another blow for the EFF, and we'll have to see whether the party does recover going into the next local government election. The EFF is going to be benefiting from the fact that the ANC does seem to be falling apart, which means that the party might be able to hold on or even improve in some areas, just simply because their opposition in many parts of the country is falling down. But you know, this is going to make it difficult, I think, to kind of make the case to MK voters who are thinking between the EFF and the MK. Might be thinking to themselves, well, you know, before Malema could make the case, we're the like smart version of MK, right? We actually do the reading of the revolutionary documents. We actually have the great policies. We haven't seen any of that from the EFF. Malema's policy ideas are all just regurgitations of ANC Youth League and ANC ideas that have been floating around the party forever. He is not, you know, making the case that he's more serious and more buttoned down and more kind of, you know, he's obviously not more of a rule follower than MK, I don't think, especially when you're having court judgments against you like this. So, yeah, I don't know, McCorney, any thoughts on all of that?
I have one, which is that this, when you're saying how this could improve, you know, his public image, there is a possibility because politicians are able to successfully launder their reputations by just going away from, you know, public-facing engagements for a while and then resurfacing as these reformed, mature, ready-to-lead characters. Just think here of our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa. You know, he was able to, you know, take a break from the media and the spotlight, go be a businessman, you know, go do real businessman work, and then come back with this, you know, renewed sense of a refined politician who is coming in not as, you know, somebody who's hungry for power, but as somebody who's, you know, the timing in terms of leadership couldn't be better. I think even Jacob Zuma kind of benefited from this a little bit, you know, after state capture and all the corruption drama around him. He took a hiatus, you know, from the public, and then he emerged as this leader of the MK. That could be Julius Malema, and I don't think you were ever going to get Malema out of the spotlight voluntarily. I think he was ever going to be
That's
dragged out of being president and out of being so, you know, in the public. It was going to be through a prison sentence, and here it's being delivered to him. So it could help him to not for for the country to not hear from him long enough that when he comes back, you know, he's this mature person who has put down the violent revolutionary rhetoric and is at least in public, you know, it's more calm and not as abrasive. And I think people may be even more willing to lend an ear to him as somebody who has actually gotten experience in some like hardships, you know, that could refine him.
Yeah, look, I think in theory that's all very true. You know, this idea of reinventing yourself, the idea of being out of the spotlight, and then, you know, one of the weird things going on in the world today is that nostalgia is like this incredibly powerful force. People sort of do tend to sort of romanticize things from the past, even things that were bad. And I can see, you know, exactly the scenario you're talking about. Malema gets forced out of the public spotlight. Let's say he gets the worst case scenario, he gets like, I don't know, like 2 years in jail. Goes to jail, and then he comes out and he just does this whole reinvention as like, you know, kind of young Mandela or something like that. I've emerged from prison and I'm a man tempered by my experiences. And that would play well, I think. But the thing is, Malema has never shown any kind of, that's not, doesn't seem to be in his personality. You think about someone like Mandela. Mandela was a guy who had a kind of fairly traditional background, and he had this sort of, you know, he came from this kind of almost sort of Victorian-ish culture of being very like buttoned down and responsible and gentlemanly and that kind of thing. That ain't Malema's style, as you say. I mean, it was evident through this whole sort of case. He's not acting like a persecuted revolutionary here. He's like, you know, someone who just has contempt for society and the rules that govern him. And you know, I don't know if he has it within him to pull off any such a reinvention. In fact, I think there've even been attempts to sort of reinvent him. There was one of the elections, his pictures changed from being sort of scowling son of the, you know, blood and soil type of guy to being like a smiling, thinner, more friendly looking guy. And it just didn't sell. So I don't know. Any final thoughts on this before we move on?
The muzzle is important, Nick. The part where he doesn't speak. Okay, changing his profile picture or his campaign picture, that's not going to do it quite as much as like just not hearing from him at all, right? Which, as you said, like a worst case 2 years prison sentence could achieve. But yeah, we are speaking years, donkey years into the future, because the wheels of justice do move quite slowly. So who knows even when the appeal will be set for, let alone decided.
Yeah. Well, and we still have to hear the sentence, which, as I said, you're only going to find out next year. Okay. Lastly, just an interesting little thing from the Minister of Communications, that's Solly Malatsi, who is from the DA. He was speaking this week in Cape Town to an event of a grouping of businesses from countries from the G20. Kind of forget sometimes that we're hosting the G20 this year. But anyway, he was kind of talking up the need for thinking about government regulations as being something that actually is supposed to empower things, not simply enforce compliance. The background to this is that earlier this year, Malatsi gazetted a draft policy that would allow telecommunications companies to use equity equivalents instead of black ownership and BEE compliance in order to be given licenses to compete in the market and provide, for example, internet services via satellite, Elon Musk's Starlink being the most obvious potential beneficiary of this. Malatsi said, "We all have a part to play from policy perspective in looking at the removal of those hurdles that prevent so many households and so many people who are not economically active from being able to access something as basic as a smart device, and making sure that we remove those hurdles to foster their inclusive digital transformation. It also requires, even from a regulatory perspective, that we view regulation as an empowerment tool rather than an enforcement instrument that seeks to enhance compliance rather than foster opportunity." He said that it was time to put aside ideological considerations and focus on actually making sure that, well, in basic terms, that poor people have access to the internet. Yeah, I pretty much am on board with that one, McCorney. I think this is exactly the right approach from the minister. Is he going to actually be able to pull it off? The ANC's portfolio committee in parliament has been, or the ANC chairperson has been pushing back on him very heavily, saying that he's trying to sort of circumvent the laws of the country through this regulation and change. What do you make of this?
And those private sector vultures who love transformation and support transformation, which is some of these regulations that Solly Malatsi is speaking about, are all coming out to say, well, if Starlink gets those privileges, then we also want them. So I fully support the approach that the minister is taking here when he talks about empowerment rather than enforcement. I think that, you know, the cynical approach that government has to business is often that, business only cares about, profit as its end goal. And yes, that is definitely one of the big end goals. But when it comes to things like digital connectivity and bridging the divide, it's clear which side the government is on here, right? It's that there is the one option where, people from remote communities, people from who are in the rural parts of South Africa could easily be connected with seamless internet that is fast, that is rapid, that allows them entry and access to this world of opportunity and possibility, which is the internet. The government is firmly against that over this other world where, it gets to control every element of how that connectivity takes place and who is allowed, who are the players who are allowed, and what those players can do for the government rather than what they can actually do for the community. It's been, the Starlink case has been incredibly frustrating, but also very good at exposing, again, that part of fake transformation that we critique, which is that these laws don't actually work for the majority of South Africans, even when we're looking at what appears to be an obvious case, to me at least, of the advantages to those rural communities who the government should be prioritizing versus, the 30% equity at stake here, which an international company, or 25% equity at stake here, which international companies have to give away to these historically disadvantaged groups and individuals. For me, the trade-off is easy. And for the government, it's not, because obviously the ANC government can't let go of the access it has to patronage. It has to hold on very tightly to that as a very successful, influential weapon in its arsenal. So I really welcome the approach of the minister here. And I do support that if the laws are relaxed, which they should be done across the board. But I also think that will also expose how the private sector will never truly be transparent about how detrimental these laws are until a time such as this comes where those laws can be let go of, and then they suddenly come out of the woodwork and of in support of the very transformation they supported being appended. So very, very cowardly from the private sector, but I fully applaud the minister on this step.
Now, the one thing I was worried about when there was talk potentially of Starlink getting some sort of special carve out around the time of the meeting between Ramaphosa and Trump in the Oval Office, was that the carve-out, there would just be like a special sort of crony capitalist carve-out for Starlink, and then there wouldn't be any other changes to the regulations or the economy or that kind of thing. And for me, that's the worst sort of, that just kind of perverts the whole system and makes it all, it only entrenches political patronage and connections and diplomacy. Comprehensive reform of these systems across the board to let everyone compete is the right way to go. And it seems like the minister has been pushing that approach, and I think all power to him. Gazetting it is sort of one thing. I think I'll only be happy when those first internet systems are in the hands of those first kids in rural schools, and then that's at least one extra thing we've got in our favor. Okay. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. There will be no show on Friday, as we are having a meeting, but otherwise, cheers everyone, and have a wonderful day. Goodbye. The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.